And good morning. We're back here on Speak Up Las Cruces. I'm Daisy Maldonado, and this is my co-host, Peter Goodman. And we're going to be joined this hour by Joanna Bencomo. She is a city councilor for District 4 and mayor pro tem here in the city of Las Cruces. Good morning, Joanna. How are you?
Good morning, everyone. Buenos dias. I'm good. How are you?
And everyone out there, if you have questions for her, call us at 526-5825.
Just easy ones. Just kidding.
Yeah. Only if we like you. I think we should.
It's early in the morning, so don't ask hard questions.
If you don't like me, don't call. I'm just kidding, everyone.
Yeah, one, you're not allowed.
I didn't say that.
I said that.
So thanks for coming on this morning. Yeah. And I think when we had sort of set up this meeting, you were telling me about this process, because I actually want to hear also Peter went through it yesterday. Mm-hmm. So I really have no knowledge of what you all did. So start off there. What happened? What was it? And what was your experience?
Oh, my gosh. Yes. Let's start there. So yesterday, Peter and I and, I don't know, about 10, 15 other people maybe. I don't know how many of us were there.
At least 15.
Yes.
All your councilors.
The entire city council.
The entire city council, at least half a dozen city employees, mm-hmm. and various
a couple
news
media.
Channel 9.
And, oh, okay. Representative Rebecca Dow was there.
Yes.
I think lots of people, the invitation was wide
right.
to come
a
experience.
For another state senator was there.
Yeah.
And this is, again, Real to Real, right?
It's called Real to Real Workshop.
Real
and
like R-E-A-L to real like movies, because they're going to make
yes.
a movie of it.
Certainly
I don't think
embarrassing to think about, honestly. but it's called the Real to Real Workshop, and essentially it's set up by the police department. It's very carefully curated, like very intentionally and carefully the curriculum is set. They really, at the beginning, they set like a historical foundation, mm-hmm. Graham v. Connor at the Supreme Court. Like, they set the foundation for use of force law.
Oh, okay.
And how that comes to be and how that still operates all of these years later today, how that is the standard at the federal level and then also somewhat at the state level, even though state courts can interpret it differently. And from what I hear from the police department, slightly stricter than the federal law. Anyway, so they give us a really great foundation. Attorney Eric Scamblin, I think I'm getting his last name wrong, but he essentially, his whole firm is to train police departments on the law. As in, he's an attorney. He trains police officers on how to understand the law. So he gave a presentation, Chief Story and Sergeant Lieutenant McBride. Am I getting his last
name? Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Really gave us the training. They gave us some scenarios. They showed us some examples of some real body-worn camera footage from other departments and from Las Cruces as well. So they laid down that sort of foundation. They gave some safety tips before we went into literal scenarios.
Is this like virtual reality kind of thing?
Yes, except it's not virtual. It's live.
Oh. So you didn't put on like
virtual
goggles or whatever?
Yeah, so we had safety equipment, but it was literal scenarios where it was a sergeant who's really a phenomenal actress, quite frankly. I didn't catch the other person's name. They're role playing.
An
act. So there was five total scenarios.
Uh-huh.
Three of the first three, you go in by yourself, right? And so you get sort of the context for the scenarios. One scenario, you get context for one scenario. They say scenario live. You turn around. There's the role play. I won't tell anyone what they are in case you ever get invited to do it, and I won't give you the answers on how to cheat on the test.
But yeah, no, I had the same thought.
Yeah, I don't know.
We can make one up. It's something like, you know, you're standing.
It's a very real
officer,
scenario.
And he says, you know, you've been called to the Safeway, and there's an insane person there.
They didn't say insane person.
No, they didn't. I'm making one up.
Okay. Well, hopefully they don't use those terminology.
No, they're very careful.
No, they would be. But basically, let's say that you've been called to an altercation between a homeowner and a homeless person who has been encamped between that homeowner's home and the railroad for a week. And there's bad blood between them, and the
something like that. The scenario isn't made up. The scenario is from a real case that someone has received, a real 911 call.
Yeah,
either one they've gotten, or something that's in the in court cases.
And the three scenarios, really, the outcome is to show you, I think, the nuance of the law. Like, what do you do in that scenario? You as a person who's obviously not trained in that profession, like, how did you navigate that situation? And then the last two scenarios you do in partners. And actually, Peter and I were partners for the last two scenarios.
Okay.
And so, you know, it's... And then, okay. And then at the end of the scenarios, we do a group debrief. Everybody comes and debriefs all of them. And then they tell you the five scenarios. This is... the law here, this is how you shouldn't respond, this is what you shouldn't do.
Can I ask a question? Because you said you were talking about safety equipment. So are you also wearing a bulletproof vest and you're armed?
No. The gun seemed real. I don't know. I have very limited experience with weapons. But the gun felt real, but it has blinks. It's very loud blinks.
And you are wearing a helmet. And
goggles
sort of protection, protection over your neck and over your groin.
But they're designed to not have physical interaction.
Right.
Like, I understand that. I was just wondering, like, even providing the concept. Yeah, exactly. Like, do you feel the weight of of a bulletproof vest?
We had a harness where you strap your gun and your. I don't even know. I literally don't even know the language.
Belt and holster.
Yeah, but what's the thing where your magazine.
Magazine.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But nothing else, right? You don't have a taser. You don't have... Okay. And you don't have a vest. Like, you... So, I think so much of what I was thinking about this, and I'm an external processor, so I was up at 2 in the morning. literally, here's my journal from 2 in the morning because I was like, I got to get my thoughts out. One of the things I was thinking about, right, was like, all of it is... Some of it is very real in that, like, the scenarios are literally scenarios from cases in Las Cruces.
And they're well acted.
Very well acted. Like, they did not hold back.
Okay. That's good.
So those elements were real. Like, again, the gun is not real, but it felt somewhat real to me, an experienced person. And then there's some stuff that isn't real, right? Like, you're wearing all of this protective gear. You're wearing a helmet. You're wearing all of these things. It's in an office
right.
space.
Right. It's a controlled environment.
It's a very controlled environment. And I don't know. It left to me, lasting impression for a couple of reasons. I think one, and these are all things I want to express to Chief and Sergeant McBride, because I think... It's important for them to know. And again, I'm an external processor, so I've been processing it all night long. And here's my biggest takeaway. You know what? I bet a couple of you slept very well after yesterday.
Well, and I'd like to hear Peter's impression once. please complete your thoughts.
Yeah, let me say this last thing, and then I'll let you lead the conversation. There's so much I could say. So anyway, that's the whole curriculum. We come back, we debrief as a group, and they really do go through, like, the laws and all these things. Anyway, one of the biggest takeaways was, one, I think it's important to just be in relationship with people in the police department. I think there are stories that get spun about, I'll stay with me for a second, about my philosophy on policing, and these stories get spun and it makes it seem like I'm not someone who's willing to engage in conversation or be in relationship with someone who holds this position. That's not true at all, right? So, like, that was one good takeaway, I think. The other takeaway that has me a little bit more agitated in a good way is that I think this experience left some people feeling really affirmed in their beliefs of... You back the blue no matter what. You support the police no matter what. Their job is hard. It's complicated. So you have to support them no matter what. easy peasy, slept great last night probably. Me, on the other hand, I think probably some of my other colleagues, I think for me what it allowed was, like, it expanded my, like, ability to stay in the discomfort of the nuance of all of this, right? Like, it is complicated and we should engage in these conversations. What I think was ultimately missing was a discussion about when it's not that gray, when an officer has acted in a way that violated somebody's rights and it ended up in harm or worse, death. I felt like there wasn't room for that discussion, and I hope to give that feedback. So that's beyond a lot of other things. Those were my initial.
Well, sure, I'm still in the zone of discomfort or whatever you call it. I think almost more so than you, in the sense that, you know, I'm a believer that we ought to have, the city ought to look into having a police oversight board because mistakes are made. I am impressed with Chief Story. I thought, you know, and I had attended something like this, not as elaborate, with the county. Mm-hmm. And also, I think we may have a phone call. So that's when you get to use the headphones.
If it's Chief Story, Chief Story, I'm going to write you an email after this.
That's true. Use those.
Good morning.
Good morning. How you doing? This is Rob McCorkle calling in to talk to the counselor and the good folks and the co-hosts of KTOP.
Good morning, caller. Sorry, we're hearing having some issues with our audio right now. Sorry about that.
Oh, that's all right. Well, I thought it was my phone.
No, you're good. Can you restate?
Welcome, caller.
Restate your comment or question.
Yes. Anyway, this is Rob McCorkle, and I've contacted the counselor before on two or three issues, and there's a real scenario I'm anxious to get a response to. There is the owner of some property at Avenida de Mesilla in Stern, right next to Luna Rosa, and it's a lot.
Hold on a second, Rob. Can you hear okay? Okay.
And it's a lot that's been full of a pile of debris for a long time. The city finally took care of the eyesore of District 4. Thank you very much. And this is another eyesore that's nothing's happening to it. I know that talking to Codes, Mr. Roach, that a complaint was filed in municipal court about a year ago, a little more than a year ago now, against this owner, and he or she was summoned to court on May 23rd last year. And he's lawyered up, as I'm told, and that's all that he could tell me, that we have to wait for the next step in the courts. My question is, like, how long does one have to wait? I mean, is municipal court that busy?
You know, I'll take that question because I served as an alternative municipal court judge for a while, not just.
Okay. Oh, there you go.
And, you know, it's a criminal procedure against the landowner. It's not civil. A felony, but it's a misdemeanor, and he could be sentenced, he or she, and therefore that they lawyer up and they have rights to slow things down. You should be able to find out with if you have the case number or even the defendant's name, you should be able to go to Muni Court and get a look at the file. It's public, and get a information as to what the next court date is. And, you know,
well, I have neither, Peter. I have no case file, no owner's name.
Right.
So how is one going to proceed in that situation?
Let's talk about this off air.
Okay.
And
it's
not something she could properly interfere in anyway, either to protect the guy or to make the penalties worse. So, you know how to reach me. I'll try to help you find out information about the timing.
Well, I called because it is in District 4. And so she is the counselor for District 4. And I know she was aware of this issue because she was copied on it. So I don't know if there's anything can speed it along or not, or she can intervene, but
she cannot. She can't intervene at all in a criminal case, even if it's District 4. You know, it's just not be wholly improper. You know, if she'd called me up when I was serving as an alternate judge and said, I want to affect this case.
That makes me so uncomfortable. Can you imagine?
She doesn't even want to, you know, she wants to banish the thought. But holding that thought for a moment, if she'd done that, I'd say, counselor, with all due respect, you know, I got to hang up. So she can't.
Right.
I'll talk to you.
I understand. That's fine. I just know that blight in this community is substantial, and I know the council's trying to take some actions and some corridors to address that, and all I can say is, bravo, it needs to be addressed. So this is just one of them. But anyway, okay, I'll talk to you later.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Slight detour.
Yeah.
Thank you for your question, though.
So going back, you were saying, Peter, that how was your experience?
I have no idea what I was saying.
Well, yeah, we left off on your experience.
I'm in the zone of discomfort, too, in the sense that, I mean, I have had a closer look, both in a ride along many years ago when things happened that shouldn't happen, and in personal situations and in a thing like this, I've had a lot more firsthand look at police behavior and police dangers. So I sympathize with the police, but I also think we ought to be, anything, whether it's, hey, how should we handle this show next week about, you know, whatever, the musicians coming to town. The more, you know, somebody's got to make a decision eventually, but if you have leisure to talk about it, the more minds, the better, to some degree. And so I think we should be, as the city council does not agree so far, I think we should be having a police oversight board. At the same time, I don't, you know, and sort of segue to mention that we will have somebody with us next week, I think 9:30 to 10, who believes we should abolish the police. I'd like to hear more about that. In a perfect world, yeah, we wouldn't need them. Some people point out that a lot of the origins is protecting lords' private property against poor people, against the peasants, and slave catchers in the South. All true, but I have not heard an answer to the question of what the hell do you do if, you know, some of the scenarios we saw yesterday. With fake guns, we didn't do very well.
Yeah. So if I could just dig in a little deeper, because I'd like to know what, barring telling me what the scenario was, mm-hmm. I'd also be interested in just in terms of how you felt in safe. Like, did you, was it, you know, you said there were good actors. Did you feel unsafe? Did you feel the need to draw your weapon?
I did draw my weapon in one case. I should have drawn it. In another, I'm dead, by the way.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I was trying to talk a guy out of something, and he shot me. So I'm not really here.
Well,
there is a scenario that escalates. Uh-huh. I will tell you that I never felt unsafe. No. I felt adrenaline. I felt tension. Mm-hmm. I felt stress, but I never felt unsafe.
I think we felt sympathy for somebody, and once. Maybe more than one, but at least one scenario, we wanted to help somebody.
No, all scenarios for me.
Well, okay.
I think that's true. I will tell you that I drew my gun once in the last scenario, and it was a scenario that I had a partner. The first three scenarios, I didn't even touch my gun. Consciously, not like I didn't make a choice to not even draw it.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't.
Mm-hmm.
I think that says a lot about, I think there's an experiment here about like human behavior.
Yeah.
I chose a career of social work. and
service to the community. Yeah.
And many would say that being a police officer is also service to the community. Very different service, right? Like, we actually discussed implicit bias briefly. I wish we would have talked about it more. We discussed it briefly. I think one of the things I thought was interesting that Lieutenant McBride said was bias works in many different ways.
Yeah.
My bias is that I inherently see everyone as good. Like, I think at the core, everyone is good. Circumstances have led you to this place. All of that doesn't matter in a split second decision.
Right. Yeah.
Do you know? Here's my thing about, well, no, I'll stop there because I do want to get into like philosophy a little because that's been sort of knocking around in my head. But sticking to the scenario and to your question, no, I never felt unsafe. I felt Lieutenant McBride was the person that I mostly interacted with in my first three scenarios by myself. And he was very generous and he was very kind. And
I was impressed, by the way, with him. And
I think they took it easy on me. I'm not going to lie. One of the scenarios ended before I would have gotten shot in the scenario. And I think it ended because it was very clear that I was... I had my hands up the entire time.
Oh, wow.
Like,
and you were supposed to be acting as a law enforcement.
I'm the law enforcement. I had my hands up the entire time.
Supposed to have your hands on your gun. No, well, one of them anyway.
This is so far from my skill set. Like,
Me too, by the way. I did terribly. I'm dead.
And here's another thing. Like, I think the, like, you know, at one point, Lieutenant McBride in the debrief, he talked about, like, divorcing yourself from feeling and acting out in a way that is only based on the facts that you have, right? Only on the facts. What constitute like an imminent risk based on the facts, right? That's what will ultimately matter in court. I don't have that. That feels very foreign to me. I do not know how to divorce myself from my feelings. That is not an experience. I have the opposite problem. I'm very married to my feelings. You know what I mean? Like, do I think that's possible, mate? I guess I do. That feels very foreign to me, but I guess I do feel like that is a possibility for someone else. And I think it's a skill. I don't know how you teach that skill. So my fear then, my concern is that there is officers who don't know how to do that. And then yet we are still expecting them to do so. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a conversation I really want to have with Chief Story and Lieutenant McBride.
Yeah.
And it's... For me, in its example, it's an example of how civilians, although they may not have the knowledge the police have, may be able to help. One of the things I kept wanting to say, we saw a video in which we saw a terrible video, chest camera on a police officer in Georgia where he stops a guy in a truck who gets out and starts dancing around and yelling, "I'm a Vietnam veteran." And ultimately, there's a gun battle and the police officer, we think, dies. I mean, it sure sounds like he gets shot to death. And I kept wishing he could have said to the police officer, when the police officer, "I'm a Vietnam veteran," he's trying to threaten him, just say, "Thank you for your service. We have to deal with this tail light, but, you know, thank you for your service. My father served, whatever." Yeah. And but more than that, listening to that officer, there's a calmness, and I don't know how you teach it, but I think you can to some degree. There's an inner calmness that they ought to teach. That an ability to say something, and I can't say I displayed this in the scenario, by the way, but, you know, I was much too mild. But a quiet calmness, this guy was yelling, but a quiet calmness in your directions to people.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I was curious about that, too, because this is about use of force, but is there a training that you can attend where they demonstrate how they train officers around de-escalation?
Yeah, I would love to train that. I have not been to that. I would love to personally attend that. I think a certain way. I wish he was here. Sorry, Peter just had to
leave step really out. Quickly. Yeah.
but I think there's, and I hope that you have someone like, have you ever had Allison Stone? Well, Allison is now with FYI, but she was one of the social workers at the fire department for a long time. I don't know if you've ever had someone from the light team.
No, I don't think so.
I would love to connect you to one of them.
Okay.
To come talk to you about their experience.
Yeah.
In a 911 response situation, but they're social workers and EMTs, right? Mm-hmm. Responding and like what their experience is. I'm removed from that in a way, right? So, but I would love to for you guys to get a take from someone who literally does crisis management.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, oftentimes, right, police officers are asked to...
We do ask them to do
right,
that.
Yep. To address those situations. So...
And you will still never have the training that a licensed social work does, right?
Well, no, absolutely. Yeah. So I'm just wondering, like, then what how much do they get? You know, I think, I mean, no, Peter had mentioned the use of force training, you know, that happened years ago with the county. Mm-hmm. And that was also sort of, well, anyway, my takeaway from that, and I'm curious your thoughts, but it was sort of painted like, again, we ask officers, you know, we ask law enforcement to go out and protect our community. And what, like, the first thing is like, they're trying to protect themselves first.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, that's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is actually the biggest evidence that I feel like I have to make the argument about why we should invest in many other different kinds of interventions before we get to this. Like, that was one of the... I think, again, maybe this is how it affirmed my beliefs already, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because often... We ask police officers to be the one and only intervention in somebody's worst day, whether that is suicidal, homicidal, whether that is struggling with fentanyl addiction, any like some sort of mental health disorder,
right?
In a domestic violence situation, we are asking police officers to be the end all be all of this intervention. I think that is an impossible ask. So, ideally, we would be investing in programs that help addiction, that help people with mental illness, so that the intervention comes before a police officer has to be called. Right. And the reality is that systemically, we do not invest in those kinds of things.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I'm thinking, you know, recently I saw on social media those officers were called out. I'm sure you saw this and... This individual, you know, there was a standoff and he came out and they sent in a canine who took him down. And I thought, wow, that's okay. Good that he wasn't, you know, like use of force wasn't implemented. But then we still caused harm to this person. And yes, for whatever reason, you know, that that the law enforcement need to be called out. I don't know. It bothers me that he had his hands up and he was walking out and he was, you know, essentially surrendering. And then we still, law enforcement still made the decision then that they're going to take him down with a canine. So I don't know. I also struggle with that. Right. And can we do something else? Can we do something else that isn't causing more harm?
Yeah. I think this is the biggest sort of agitation that I was left with. Right. Like the idea that like, and I think one of the things Peter said about this one video that they showed from like 1989 or something, I don't even remember. No, that was Graham B. Conner. I don't know when this one with the Vietnam vet was, but one of the things that the court will not take into consideration is hindsight 2020. Well, you should have done this like that, which I do agree with. That's actually a learning I took away from yesterday, right? Like, it is easy to sit on this other side and be like, well, you should have done X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
I think that is ultimately unfair. What I do think, though, is that, you know, the attorney had a quote, I don't know, from The Art of War. I don't remember the quote.
Sun Tzu, yeah.
But it was like something about being prepared.
Basically,
when
every battle is won or lost before it starts.
Yeah, something like that, right? Like the idea is that prepare when things are not in crisis. Like, how do you further prevent a crisis? Actually, his example was really good. He said, I just bought a house. There was a light rain and there, I had a leak. And instead of fixing it when there was no rain and maybe roofers weren't busy, I forgot, put it off. And then there was monsoons and now I have a bigger problem and everyone's busy and I have a bigger problem. So how do you prevent that? Mm-hmm. And I feel like he was obviously talking about training police officers.
Right.
I want to take that and talk about how do we invest in things that further prevent someone from going into crisis? That is the conversation I want to have.
Yes. I think.
And then I feel like maybe there's not it's like too much of a, well, how are you going to pay for that? I don't know how we pay for
police. Just saying.
A lot of enforcement.
All the things we try to do in terms of helping kids when they're very young, in terms of helping parents to be able to help their kids, in terms of education, in terms of housing.
But the conversation right now about juveniles is more prison, more incarceration, more punishment.
Yeah.
To me, that is not preparing. No, to me, that is making it worse.
I agree. I think, unfortunately, one thing we do is the police end up being the garbage collectors in the sense
we were sort of having that conversation as you walked away.
Our social garbage, and I don't mean the people are garbage, but the problems are, ends up in their lap. And
the
they
social
have to
challenges.
Do the social work.
Correct.
When they're, unlike Japan, where you have to have a bachelor's degree.
No,
to be
it's
a
an
cop.
That we were talking about that is an impossible job, and in many ways, we are asking them, and this is, I was telling Daisy, like, this is my biggest evidence for why we should invest in more crisis intervention and things like that, because we are asking them to do impossible work in impossible, law scenarios. The law is so nuanced and it is not objective, it is just not.
The law is not objective.
The people interpreting the law is not objective. You think the Supreme Court is objective?
No.
Okay.
No.
Not today.
not right now.
Not right now.
I think most people charged with enforcing the law, certainly judges, make an effort at that and do better than the
no
Supreme
shade.
Court. Yeah,
my apologies. No shade on many, many judges that I think are deeply ethical. I also think that the buck stops at the Supreme Court with many of these cases often. And right now, I do not believe that they are objective.
Our national political situation is deeply unfortunate. And let's not get too much into that.
No, we don't have to.
We did that earlier.
My point is that I think there's so much nuance in all of this, and we are asking.
I'll be interested when our guest next week, who wants to abolish the police, presumably saying that we can, use social workers instead in some situations, or I don't want to put words in the person's mouth, but I'll be interested in what the proposals are.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people are saying abolish the police. What do they do?
Yeah. I think do you want to get into that? I have some thoughts on the philosophy of all of that.
Okay. Let's do that. And then I have a related question.
Okay.
Actually, I'll ask the related question, get it out of the way, because somebody asked me recently. Okay. They'd gone to a city council meeting and somebody had talked about a situation where I visited with a small business owner on a Sunday, and he had homeless people, basically do a lot of damage.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I share your feeling that, homeless people are homeless people, and they're not all criminals. Most of them are not. People have civil liberties, whether they have homes or not. But a lot of the counselors and other do-gooders who say that then go to their homes in Sonoma.
I don't live in Sonoma Ranch.
No, I know you don't.
Okay.
And I don't. But a lot of people are insulated from, this guy had to clean up human defecation or fix damage or erase obscenities that I can't say on the air written on his place of business a lot of mornings. And he's kind of on the front line suffering for the fact, for our, I think, well thought out laws and are trying to do the right thing. Are we, as a city, trying to help him and others like him?
I think so.
Okay. I mean, I think we are.
We have a store. We have a storefront repair program. There is, I know the mayor and Councilor Graham were working on bringing in a third-party company to help clean up any feces. Mm-hmm. And Mano y Mano is helping with any unsanctioned encampments. I think we're doing genuinely everything in our power. If I have a blind spot, I would like to be told. But often I feel like I'm met with, you need to literally remove human beings to somewhere else. And that is not actually a reasonable solution.
No.
You can be upset. You can be frustrated. And I understand why you should be. I also, you know, I would love to live in a utopia with zero crime and zero unhoused people. Like, homelessness should make us uncomfortable and it should make us frustrated. And we have right now nearly 600 affordable units being built. Within 1 year, those will be live and people will be ready to live with them. You know who fights those people most? Those projects most? The people who have the most to say about unhoused people. I have come to realize that the thing people hate more than unhoused people is housing for unhoused people.
And why do you think that is?
Well, you know, I've also noticed that the same people who shout loudest about you shouldn't have abortions want to do away with birth control. What sense does that make?
Yeah, no, it's really, I think it's about control.
I just wanted to ask you that question because I think it's important that somebody had
I would love
me.
To talk to that person. If that person wants to reach out to me, I would love to talk to them.
I'll advise him.
Yeah, please.
You know, he wasn't focused on you particularly, but he just had heard what a speaker said.
I think we're doing a lot. But if we can do more and there's ideas for more, because I acknowledge that I have blind spots, I want to hear ideas from people that aren't move people to the fairgrounds.
What about, and by the way, we're going to wind up this discussion pretty soon and talk with school superintendent Ignacio Ruiz for the last 15, 20 minutes. But what do you want to say about the philosophy of?
Yes. I, in community organizing, I learned this principle that said, the further you are from the issue, the easier it is to philosophize about it. And it could be anything, actually. Mm-hmm. Homelessness. If you've never been chronically homeless or are in deep relationship with someone who is experiencing homelessness, it could be really easy to say, why are you homeless? Just don't be.
Well, right, get a job.
Don't poop on the street. Yeah. Go poop somewhere else. Right? Like, it is easy to philosophize about this pain, this situation, when you are removed from it, right? And that isn't any experience. I think that could apply in two ways to the police scenario. One, yesterday, I think it gave us an insight on, it is easy for me as a politician to philosophize about the work of a police officer on the ground in Las Cruces, right? Like, in our city. It is easy for me to philosophize about it because I'm removed. And that experience yesterday helped that a little bit, right? Helped move that a little bit. I also think, though, that it is easy to philosophize about the issues of, like, systemic use of force, police brutality, when you are not someone who has been targeted with racial profiling, when you are not someone, honestly, like, in Black, Indigenous communities of color, this isn't made up. Like, this is a fact, right? Like, there is systemic abuses in one particular community, the Black community. And I think it's easy to philosophize about, we'll just comply. We'll just say what, do what they say. Like, all of these things, right? And I feel like I wish there was more of a willingness to have conversations about those things. I've read about abolition and many different things, incarceration and all of these things. And I think too many systems need to be repaired in order for that to work. The healthcare system being primarily one of them, the housing system, jobs, living wages, right? So, like, I think we can live in that world where we want to abolish these harmful, these systems that have been historically harmful. I have to navigate my political environment here.
Yeah.
I have two more years on the city council and I have to navigate that political reality here, being one of a seven person body that is in a council manager form of government that, right? Like, there's a, I have to think about what can I do now?
Right.
What can I do today? And that's the conversations I want to have.
Well, thanks for having the conversation we're having with us today.
Thank you for coming.
Sorry it's not going to be longer.
I know.
There was a scheduling screw-up. I'm sure it was my fault.
Well, bring me back. I want to talk about blight and the metropolitan redevelopment areas.
There's a lot to talk about. Yeah.